Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. On today's show, we'll feature the first of a two-part interview with the noted author, film producer, and blogger, Danny Schechter. We'll also present a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a report about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Last month, Media Minutes reported on the Facebook user backlash against a system called Beacon that spreads information to other users about their online activities. Since that story, it's become increasingly clear that online data mining is much more pervasive and secretive. Jeff Chester, executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy, is a longtime champion of individual rights in an increasingly corporate digital environment. He says the recent backlash sent social networks an important message, but it represents only a small part of how Facebook is collecting your information on the Beacon system.
There are so-called social ads where they're selling your profile information, including your political affiliation, to advertisers. They're allowing others, so-called third parties, to come in and send in data collection widgets that send out to their owner information about you. Facebook is offering big advertisers something called, quote, integrated packages, where they're giving them special deals to learn about you and to target you.
Chester says that social networks now exist primarily for marketers to get more information about us. His wife, Catherine Montgomery, is a professor in the School of Communications at American University, where she directs the Project on Youth, Media, and Democracy. They often work together on privacy issues.
The paradigm for marketing and advertising in the emerging media system is focused on targeting individuals and on extensive data collection and profiling that raises fundamental privacy issues and that is very, very different from anything we've seen before.
Montgomery is also concerned about how kids are being used to collect data online. She and Chester were instrumental in pushing the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act through Congress in 1998, legislation which offered some safeguards against predatory advertising to kids under 13. In her book, Generation Digital: Politics, Commerce, and Childhood in the Age of the Internet, she says teens are particularly vulnerable to micro-targeted advertising.
They're developing their social relationships and kind of learning the ropes of social interaction, and they're becoming more independent. So these are sort of sites for developing the person and for becoming kind of a full human being as young people grow up. And they're entered into for all kinds of important, kind of very interesting personal reasons, but they're being used for other purposes that young people may not be familiar with and may not be aware of.
Montgomery worries that the public has begun to unquestioningly accept a surveillance society.
The surveillance that takes place in the name of security by the government is in some ways sort of converged with the surveillance that is becoming state-of-the-art and very commonplace in the corporate sector. And it's all evolving without, I think, enough public discussion and public debate. And we need to all be very aware of it and be concerned about it. And, you know, I think we need to put our feet down in some of these areas. So far, there are just a few civil liberty groups, a handful at least, that are fighting some of the government actions that really do invade privacy in very dangerous ways. And we need more people to take a stand and say, that's enough. You're not crossing over that line.
advertising is going to be shaping much of our experience online. At the very least, we can make this entire process conscious and give individuals, consumers, citizens, real people control over the data. What's required is something called opt-in. That means your data isn't collected till you know about it and you agree. What the big companies want the default to be is something called opt-out, which means that they can collect all this information about you and use it at will. We want to reverse the process and try to restore some democratic safeguards to this very powerful new media culture we're living in.
For more information about online privacy issues, go to democraticmedia.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
Hardly a story is done about the killings in Kenya without reference to the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. Although the events are entirely different in both scope and historical background, facts make little difference to Western reporters, who lump all mass bloodletting in Africa under the same implicit category: African barbarism, savagery, and immutable tribalism. No further explanation is considered necessary. Not that any would be forthcoming from most non-African journalists, few of whom bother to acquaint themselves with the actual histories of African nations, and virtually none of whom trace the current crises in Africa to colonial rule. No, African savagery is sufficient to explain everything. Thus, Kenya 2008 equals Rwanda 1994. In Kenya, it appears that as many as 1 million votes may have been stolen by the ruling party, dominated by Kikuyu people, in last month's elections. Hundreds have died and thousands been displaced as the opposition, particularly the Luo ethnic group, demands new elections. Western reporters almost uniformly lament that Kenya has long been a beacon of democracy in post-colonial Africa, forgetting to mention that dictator Daniel Arap Moi ruled the country for 24 years to the great profit and political satisfaction of Britain and the United States. Few reporters point out, or even seem to know, that it was the British who, as Kenyan independence approached, drew electoral boundaries to cut the representation of groups they thought might cause trouble. In the United States, that's called gerrymandering, a corruption of the electoral process. In Kenya, according to Harvard African Studies professor Carolyn Elkins, it was the Brits' method of continuing their legacy of tribal manipulation, even after they were no longer colonial masters. As Professor Elkins writes, both ethnic conflict and its attendant grievances are colonial phenomena. The Belgians worked tribalism to maximum effect and profit in Rwanda, a country that even in pre-colonial times had been dominated by the Tutsi minority. The Belgians made it official, distributing identification cards designating Tutsis and Hutus, and favoring the Tutsis in colonial business, education, and politics, thus hardening the ethnic divide. The Tutsi military regime that took power after the genocide and the defeat of Hutu nationalists is now one of Washington's two most trusted clients in Africa, along with the military strongman in Uganda, who has presided over horrifically brutal policies against the Akoli people of that country. Tribalism has many uses for imperialists who strongly encourage such divisions. It is, of course, perfectly suited to divide and conquer strategies of direct or indirect rule. It is also a convenient Euro-supremacist explanation for whatever ails Africa. The Brits and the Americans have urged Kenyans to behave responsibly, as if it is an innate, childlike African irresponsibility that is the source of the problem. The former colonizers and current imperialists have no positive role to play in Kenya, only a desire to preserve their own economic and military interests. they ought to stay the hell out. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
The New World Resource Center presents We Are Many, Inquiries into Chicago Activism. It's a series of presentations highlighting the struggles and successes of Chicago area activists and organizers looking to connect the political to the everyday. The series is held every second Thursday at 7 p.m. at 1300 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. For more information, visit myspace.com/NWRC for the New World Resource Center.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. We now feature the first of a two-part interview with the noted author, film producer, and blogger, Danny Schechter. The following interview was recorded on Sunday, January 13, 2008. We are on the phone with Danny Schechter. Danny Schechter is a prolific author, documentary filmmaker, media producer, and blogger. He's the executive producer of Global Vision, the noted TV and film production company. He's also the executive editor of the worldwide media resources network MediaChannel.org and is the author of numerous books, including Embedded, Weapons of Mass Deception, How the Media Failed to Cover the Iraq War, and a prolific filmmaker. Among his many films is his most recent film, In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Bursts. And Danny Schechter is joining us on the phone from, I presume you're in New York City?
New York City.
All right. Well, Danny Schechter, thank you so much for joining us.
To the second city.
Thank you very much for joining us, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's begin by talking about In Debt We Trust. For the listeners who may not be familiar with the film, could you briefly explain what is the movie about and why did you make the film?
Well, look out the window, people. You know, in Chicago, for example, you'll find that 30% of homes in certain communities are about to be foreclosed upon because people got tied up with fraudulent subprime scam loans and are now in danger of losing their homes as the rates of those loans adjust upwards and they find themselves without the money to actually pay their bills. We're in an economic recession right now. My film, which was made, you know, I started making it in 2005, was a warning of the danger of these loans, the credit card squeeze on Americans, the student loan crisis, you know, and the subprime lending, which, you know, has now come back to haunt us with hundreds of billions of dollars, some say $2 trillion, written down by big banks and lost from the economy because of all of these practices of securitizing loans. In other words, you know, somebody would give you a loan and they would take the paper, they'd sell it into Wall Street. Wall Street would chop it up into little pieces and sell it all around the world. Everybody was making money. But now the chickens have come home to roost, in a sense, and we have a crisis in our economy, a recession. The New York Times today on the front page says it may be too late to do anything about it. So a lot of people were asleep at the switch here in terms of not paying attention to this problem, our politicians, for one, the regulators, secondly, and thirdly, our media, which didn't take this crisis very seriously, which tried to put it, you know, a good sort of face on it, you know, that there's been a big turnaround here, look at Christmas shopping, isn't it going to be wonderful? As it turns out, it wasn't wonderful. It was the fifth worst, you know, the worst shopping year ever. So we're in a situation now where the truth about what's happening in our economy, what's happening in Iraq, is not really being conveyed to the American people, in part because our media is not covering it well. And in fact, our media is complicit in it. I made a film called WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, about the role of the media in promoting the Iraq War. And what I find here is a similar level of complicity in terms of economic crisis, where many media institutions did not investigate these problems, even though people came to them and told them, about predatory lending and the rest. And I think the reason is that they were getting billions of dollars in advertising from mortgage companies, from credit card companies, you know, and the like. You can see it still all over the internet, you know, ads for, you know, for loans and, you know, debt consolidation, et cetera, and so forth. And because of their economic interests, I believe, in accepting all this money, they didn't go after their advertisers. Their advertisers were involved in corrupt practices, and many have now admitted it by actually writing down billions of dollars in loans. So we're in a economic crisis now. The polls are showing that the voters think the economy is a much more serious problem than anything else. They're really worried about it. Politicians are beginning to speak up, and the Times is saying today it's too late. You know, so we're in for it in a very serious way. It's something we need to think more about. We have to be concerned about the reporting on economic issues and whether or not that reporting is being skewed. The other day, Jesse Jackson was in New York holding what's called the Wall Street Project, where people in the business world and advocacy communities come together. And he had four of the five FCC commissioners there. Kevin Martin, the chairman, wasn't there. He came the next day. But four of them were there. And I challenged them about this whole advertising issue. I said, wait a minute. Don't you think that this is something that the media has been complicit in and actually helping to sell these crooked loans to the American people? And, you know, they basically, cops basically agreed with me. Yes, it was a problem, but really it's the Federal Trade Commission, not the FCC, that should look into this. And, you know, sort of a buck-passing situation. Or I think they just weren't paying attention to this problem. And I think... We're in a very serious economic situation. That media has to be an advocate for the truth, has to tell the truth about what's happening, has to investigate the practices of these big banks and other, institutions.
Mm-hmm. What you had just described could lead me into a number of follow-up questions in a variety of directions.
Please.
Let me begin with this. You quoted the New York Times article. I happen to have it here on my computer. Headline, No Quick Fix to Downturn, published on January 13, 2008, where basically it says, just to quote from the first line of the of the article, as leaders in Washington turn their attention to efforts to avert a looming downturn, many economists suggest that it may be already too late to change the course of the economy over the first half of the upcoming year, if not longer. So it seems that now even the establishment media is now acknowledging what you've been talking about and researching for years.
They were saying there may be a recession. Now they're saying, you know, because Merrill Lynch and a bunch of other big banks have said there is a recession, they're accepting that the recession is already here. Rather than hire their own economists to really analyze this thing, they've been basically relying on self-interested parties, people who either had an interest in trying to keep things upbeat in order to keep people spending money and or buying shares, in the stock market, rather than to try to tell the people what's really going on. And what's really going on is very scary, and that's the message of the film In Debt We Trust. And In Debt We Trust, by the way, has yet to be shown in Chicago. It's a feature, documentary. It's been at leading film festivals, and it's very relevant because it deals with how this whole debt situation developed, how our economy has shifted from an economy built around production, factories, into consumption, malls. Two-thirds of the economic activity in America is about consumption. So selling us, products, this has become, marketing has become the role, really, of the media, increasingly. And so they don't really kind of critique or criticize, these advertisers and these big institutions that are involved in consumption. They're part of the whole system, and including the real estate market, where real estate classified ads are a very big source of revenue for leading newspapers. Consumer goods, big stores advertise heavily during the Christmas season on television. Of course, you always see those reports the day after Thanksgiving. We're at the mall and it's just amazing here, and all these people are, they inflate and encourage a kind of herd attitude of going and shopping, basically. And what happens is the first initial reports are always, look at all the people at the mall, it's doing great, blah, 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 blah. Then comes Christmas and MasterCard issues a report, as they did this year, and found that, the actual amount of the transactions were very disappointing. Apparently, people were only buying the heavily discounted big items like, the big TV sets, the new TVs, et cetera, and so forth, and not buying other things. And in fact, a lot of these stores have had to deeply discount everything. They've had a terrible season and the rest. I don't, wish that for them, but I think that it's important for us to understand why and to try to get the media into being an advocate for consumers and citizens. I mean, we're in a situation now where people are finding it harder and harder to pay their bills. I mean, I just shown a report here about late payments on consumer debt, you know, such as automobiles, home equity, and home improvement loans rose to 2.44% of all such loans in the third quarter. That's the highest delinquency rate since the second quarter of 2001, when the economy was in a recession. So, you know, here we go again. Now, of course, you're always going to have business cycles in a capitalist system. But in this particular case, we should know about this. We should have policies that deal with this, and we don't right now. So finally, you know, civil rights leaders, people like Jesse Jackson, are taking the lead here, basically trying to do something about it, you know, because they're feeling, that this is wiping out, you know, the black community, but it's also affecting everyone else as well.
What do you think should be done about it?
Well, I mean, I'm not an economist, but it seems to me clear that, first of all, we have to get rid of predatory lending practices, these kind of deceptive advertising, this kind of targeting of people, giving them the idea that there's free money out there, that they can get these very expensive homes without having to pay for them. I think that's one thing we can easily do. The second thing we have to do is reinstitute regulation of big companies and financial markets right now because of government policies, which started, by the way, not just in the Bush administration, but in the Clinton administration and earlier, you know, to kind of erode regulations and regulations in the public interest that protect people against these kinds of practices. So, you know, as a result of the lack of, you know, people paying attention, the lack of regulators, the lack of policies, we're in the crisis we're in now. In Illinois, fortunately, you have, a state attorney general who is taking the lead and is investigating some of these practices, is issuing subpoenas to lending companies like Countrywide, which was just absorbed by the Bank of America.
You're referring to
taking a high-profile stance on these issues. The state legislature in Illinois has also been doing a lot. That's because we can't seem to get change at the federal level. So it's all up to each state. You know, in New York State, the Attorney General, Andrew Cuomo, began to investigate student loans, and he found that large colleges were actually using their financial aid officers to steer students to more expensive loans and getting payoffs in the process. Columbia University, a big Ivy League school, has paid a $1 million settlement with the state of New York because it was caught doing this. And other universities and colleges are doing it as well because, you know, it's a way, for example, give me the membership list of Media Action in Chicago. Then I can target all of those people with credit card offers and the like. I probably wouldn't do too well with your members, but still,
you get the idea, what
they're doing. Colleges are strapped for money, so they're marketing, you know, they're selling the names of their students and other people, you know, to these big companies. And the consequence of this is that students are paying more, and many of them are in a terrible squeeze themselves trying to, pay their bills.
You had alluded to that of our attorney general. I presume you're referring to Lisa Madigan.
Lisa Madigan, yes. I met her in New York. I was impressed with her dedication on this issue.
You've been alluding that there's been state-level actions to try to remedy the situation where the federal government has been kind of lax. Do you know if that's happening state-by-state across the country?
Yeah, it's happening in many states. But, you know, it's not enough and it's not adequate. The federal government has passed some anti-predatory lending legislation, but it's pretty weak. And so there's a whole movement developing around this issue with Jackson and a lot of organizations taking the lead. There'll be demonstrations at HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Agency, on January 22nd, the day of the State of the Union address in Washington. There were demonstrations in Chicago on LaSalle Street, also on Wall Street, earlier this month. So there is a sort of fight back beginning to emerge on this issue because it sort of unites everybody. I mean, you know, blacks, whites, ethnics, students, you know, even Republicans are hurting. You know, this is not, Now, of course, the super rich may not be, but gradually what's happening is everybody is being affected by this. If a house next door to your house goes into foreclosure, your house will lose value. You know, your neighborhood will lose value, and et cetera, and so forth. If there are houses that are empty and abandoned and become crime scenes, people are not going to want to live there, and it's going to be harder for people to sell their homes. So, you know, this has a ripple effect throughout the economy and also throughout the world that we have to try to understand and do something about. Unfortunately, the progressive community doesn't pay that much attention to economic issues, you know, and partly because maybe because it's middle class and it's not, you know, is interested in economic justice issues and the like, maybe because the war is so horrible, people are more active on the war front. But this is something we have to pay attention to, if only for our economic survival. Let me just say, to any of your listeners who want to know more, you know, we have an InDebtWeTrust.com website about the film, and we have a website called StopTheSqueeze.org. And StopTheSqueeze.org is, I write a regular blog on that too about economic issues, and also, of course, I write on the News Dissector blog on MediaChannel.org, trying to follow up these developments in this news. I've just written about that New York Times article, which will be up on Media Channel later tonight. So, you know, I'm trying to follow this and monitor this. I'm just one person. I can't, you know, substitute for an entire media. But there have been some good stories in the Chicago media about predatory lending, some investigative pieces and the like. And we need more of it. You know, we need to really hold these people's feet to the fire and really analyze this, follow the money, figure out who's, you know, getting rich off of other people's misery.
That was the first of a two-part interview with the noted author, film producer, and blogger, Danny Schechter. Danny Schechter's blog is online at www.newsdissector.com. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.